Thanks very much. Well, it's very nice to be back here. I feel this is more like a group meeting than a regular seminar, since it's not that long ago that I left Perimeter. And so today I would like to tell you a little bit about the stuff that I've been doing in the past year or so. And it's actually two slightly different things, but basically about these quantum antibody systems, which are some systems that look like this. So, you know, if we could build a Hilbert space microscope, this is at least how I imagine these systems would look like. Now, the problem is that, of course, experimentalists are not yet good at building such microscopes, so then we have to use theoretical measurements to see structures like this. And one of the best ones, I mean, most complete ones, perhaps, is this entanglement spectrum. So, just to introduce things a little bit, so in the context of entanglement spectrum, so we talk about the pure quantum antibody state, and then we want to learn stuff about it. So one thing we can compute is this object, which is called the reduced density matrix. So we split our system in two parts, A and the complement, B, and then we trace out degrees of freedom. We trace out the subsystem B, and then we are left with this object rho A, the reduced density matrix that describes the subsystem A. And from that, we can compute various quantum informational quantities, such as, for example, the von Neumann entropy. And then we can learn various useful things. So one useful thing that we can learn about from this is if we ask how does that entropy scale with the size of our subsystem. And so, for example, if that entropy is identically zero, then we know that we have a product state. So it's an unentangled, very simple state. The opposite limit is when that entropy is very large, it grows as a volume of our subsystem. And that's what happens with random states or thermal states. And then there is also the in-between limit when that entropy scales as the area of the subsystem and then perhaps plus some subleading corrections, which turn out to be quite interesting. And that's what's known as area law. So that certainly gives us some nice information about these systems. But as I said, we want to see if there is more information inside of this object. And then comes the idea of the entanglement spectrum. So now instead of looking at this single quantity, which is a von Neumann entropy, we look at the full spectrum of the Schmidt coefficients of that state psi. And this spectrum was first introduced in the context of the fractional quantum Hall effect. And that spectrum basically identifies the topological order that you find in these states. So for example, if you look at it for a Laughlin state, one-third state, so you can plot these Schmidt coefficients as a function of some quantum number. These systems have a lot of symmetry, so there's some kind of symmetry quantum number, like momentum. So you can plot these coefficients as a function of that momentum, and then suddenly it looks like an energy spectrum of some system. And funnily enough, it looks like a gapless energy spectrum, although the original state was actually gapped. So then if you look at these excitations, like energy levels, and you count how many they are, you find essentially a fingerprint of that state. So that counting contains important topological content about the state. And then it's even more interesting if you go to more complicated state, like some state which is called the Moore-Reed state. So that's some fractional quantum Hall state that occurs at the filling of two electrons per four orbitals. And now the interesting thing is that depending on how you cut this state, so if you cut it, for example, between two empty orbitals or between two electrons which are next to one another, you're going to get different countings. So in this case, you would get the counting, if you zoom in on this piece here, it would look like 1, 1, 3, etc. Whereas in this case, if you zoom in, it would look like 1, 2, 4, okay? So you see that there's a clear difference between these two cases, and that turns out to be connected to the fact that the state has non-abelian excitations. So it comes from a more complicated topological order. Okay, so that's That's something that was done with this entanglement spectrum in the original content, the motivation. But now we would like to know, is there some more generic content in that entanglement spectrum? In this example here, we relied on these symmetries, for example, these quantum numbers, to resolve and plot this spectrum. But what if that symmetry is not available? So you have some disordered system and there's no symmetry. Okay, so it's still interesting to ask, is there some generic content which can still tell us about our system even in those cases? And so that would be the basic motivation for this talk. So as I said, it will be in two parts. The first part, I will tell you a little bit about what we found regarding the universal properties of this entanglement spectrum when you have strongly disordered interacting systems. So some kind of spin model where you have strong on-site disorder. And so we will see that there are some indeed universal properties of entanglement spectrum in that case. So that's what I will tell you about in the first half. And in the second half, will be something slightly different. I'll ask the question, can you use this entanglement spectrum as some kind of diagnostic to essentially measure how far that state is from some closest possible free state? So in a sense, to use the entanglement spectrum as a diagnostic to tell you whether the ground state that you're looking at is close to some free state or is it some genuinely interacting state. Okay, so you can find more information about these two topics in the two preprints here. Okay, so the first part of my talk is about strongly disordered interacting systems. And one exciting development in recent years about these systems is that we realized that they can display a phenomenon which is called many-body localization. So we can arrive at that phenomenon by thinking about this very general question, which is, what is the generic behavior of isolated quantum many-body systems at arbitrary temperature? So you take some quantum many-body system, it's isolated, there's no thermal bath, or if there is a thermal bath, you include it inside of that system. And then you ask the question, how does that system behave? Okay, so it evolves under its own dynamics, so what kind of possible states can it reach? And funnily enough, that's still an open problem, even in one dimension where we usually know quite a lot about, let's say, ground states of systems, because we have lots of techniques to study that kind of physics. So one thing that I want to emphasize here is that in the context of this many-body localization, we are not really obsessed about the physics of the ground state, as we usually are, for example, in these topological quantum Hall systems. But we also care about highly excited states of the system, because we want to know about dynamical properties and arbitrarily high temperatures, so then these states also matter. Okay? And for concreteness, we can think about one-dimensional systems, because there's enough of rich physics already in that case. And we can think about some isolated spin chain. So we have nearest neighbor hopping between spins, nearest neighbor interactions, and there's some quenched disorder, which is like a random field on every side. So that's a 1D spin chain, like a Heisenberg model. So it looks like that. But of course, we know in 1D, we can always do a John-Wigner transformation. And then this problem is essentially the same as a spinless Hubbard model. So you have fermions, which are hopping between nearest neighbor sites. And then there's also nearest neighbor interaction. And then there's a random chemical potential on every site. So we will be thinking about models of this type. And so if we take one of these toy models, now let's discuss a little bit the phase diagram, how it looks. So we have various parameters here. We have J, V, and the magnitude, the strength of this random field, which we draw from some distribution, let's say uniform distribution. So we can set this J to be 1, and then we are left with these two parameters, the interaction and disorder strength. And so let's plot here the phase diagram as a function of interaction divided by that disorder strength. So if there are no interactions in our system, but there is some finite amount of disorder, then it's very well known in one dimension that you get Anderson insulator. So if you look at the typical state of your system, instead of a Bloch wave, which is extended throughout the crystal, it's going to look something like this. So it will have this exponential envelope given by some localization length. So all states, I mean, states typically look like this, and that's Anderson and the simple Anderson limit. On the other hand, if these interactions are very strong, then the system is in an ergodic phase. So that's like any typical quantum antibody system. So what that means is that if you had an infinite system, it would be able to act as a heat bath. So if you pick any finite subsystem, it will get equilibrated because the rest of the system is able to act as a heat bath. So you can achieve thermal equilibrium in that case. And there's finite transport, so you can transport energy, particle number, etc. And what's interesting from a point of view of entanglement is that the entropy obeys the volume law. So the entropy scales as the volume of the subsystem. Okay, and then there are some also statistical properties of these eigenstates, which I will not go into at this point. But now the interesting thing is that people haven't really, they thought that, you know, for a long time that only these two simple limits are possible in this phase diagram. But more recently, it was realized that there is actually an intermediate kind of phase in this diagram, which we now call the many-body localized phase. And that phase is interesting because it has some properties which are in between these two limits. So a big system still doesn't act as a heat bath, so the system is not ergodic. It will not reach thermal equilibrium. There is no transport, so you cannot transport, for example, particles. But there is some amount of entanglement in the system because the eigenstates satisfy this area law. So there is some amount of entanglement, but much less than in the ergodic limit. Okay, so this is the rough phase diagram as we now have figured out about this simple model. So the one question that you want to ask is, if there is that intermediate many-body localized phase, is it different in any way from Anderson, simple Anderson insulator? Yes, it is different because there are simple experiments that can distinguish them. For example, there is this quench experiment which can distinguish them. So imagine that you prepare some well-defined initial state, like you have all spins pointing up, or you have all spins pointing up, down, up, down. Then you evolve it with the time with your Hamiltonian. So the system is closed, so it's a unitary evolution. And then you observe what happens at later times. You measure some observable, for example, entanglement entropy. And of course, entanglement entropy is easy to measure numerically, not so easy in experiment, but let's just see what we get in computer experiments. So if we measure that entanglement entropy as a function of time, so this is a typical plot what it looks like. So it starts out at zero because you started from a product state. And then it grows a little bit. And now the black curve is when you have no interactions in your system. And these different curves, they correspond to various degrees of interaction. So it's clear that zero interaction is somehow different from any finite amount of interactions. So interactions are in some sense a singular perturbation on this system. So okay, so let's take a look at the time scales when this happens. So we see that this initial growth is essentially very short. It's just on the order of inverse hopping. And the entropy grows a little bit because a particle can always hop around the cut and so build some amount of entanglement. But then if there are no interaction, then it just saturates and it doesn't grow any further. On the other hand, if you have even the smallest amount of interaction, this entropy can grow further. And now if we investigate that growth, we find that it's actually logarithmic in time. So this is this growth is some kind of log t. And if we were able to do an infinite system, to simulate an infinite system, this growth would just keep on going forever. So it's a very slow growth, but it never stops. Okay, so that's that's some kind of phenomenology that you can see if you do, let's say, a numerical simulation. Another thing which is related to this, you can see similar things if you look at local observables instead of entanglement, but let's not worry about that. So the question is how we understand this, and why is this different between, why is there such a difference? Okay, so let's imagine the following modification of this simple Quench experiment. So take the spin chain, and now we measure entanglement across this bond here, but let's cut that bond. So let's not allow spins to hop around that cut. So we will leave the interaction term, but we prevent any hopping on that bond. So now the question is what this entanglement entropy will look like in this case. So you can think about it, or we can just do it on a computer. And so this is how it looks like. So now the entanglement entropy is essentially zero all the way up to J inverse of hopping. And then it starts to grow, and again it's logarithmic. Okay? So that's what happens with entropy. The other thing you can compute is you can compute the variance or a particle number in your left subsystem, and you find that that value is always very close to zero. So particles are not really hopping across this cut, but entropy is still growing logarithmically across that cut. So what kind of physics gives you this? So there are two ways you could build entanglement in this context. So you could build entanglement if you had particles moving around this cut, across the cut, right? That's one possibility. The other possibility would be if you just got some kind of effective, long-range effective interaction across the cut. And then you have no particles moving, but you just get the growth of entanglement. And the second case is exactly what happens. So basically, what this picture tells us is that if we wait long enough, any two subsystems will eventually get entangled, but we have to wait exponentially long time for that to happen. So that time is exponentially long. And basically, this simple kind of picture is what prompted us to propose an effective description of these systems, which is based on what people now call the local integrals of motion. So the statement is, coming from this, explaining this simple result here, is that if you're in the MBL phase, so you started from some original spin Hamiltonian, then you can define an effective Hamiltonian in terms of some new spins, which are called here the tau spins, and the new Hamiltonian, the effective Hamiltonian, in terms of these tau spins, is a classical Hamiltonian, so it only involves the Z components, for example, of these pseudospins. So it's a classical Hamiltonian, but it has interacting terms, for example, two-body terms and even higher-body terms. But these terms, they simply decay exponentially in separation between the particles. And so why are these taus called local integrals of motion? Because they commute with the Hamiltonian, and they also commute with each other. So they span this many-body Hilbert space, and any Hamiltonian eigenvector can be specified by giving quantum numbers of these operators. So the fact that that these operators exist then explains why entropy has to grow in this simple logarithmic way, even though particles are not moving. That's just because you have these higher and higher orders of direct interactions between the pseudospins. And there's another important consequence for the physics of these systems is that then you must have area law entanglement in your eigenstates, but that applies throughout the spectrum. So no matter what energy you pick, that the typical eigenstate of that energy will have area law entanglement. And so that essentially means that you can efficiently represent these states as matrix product states in one dimension. So this is a kind of heuristic picture that I outlined here at this point, but you can actually explicitly construct these operators, and this is something that we've been doing here while I was still here at Perimeter. So we can actually construct these local integrals of motion explicitly. So how do we do that? Well, we have this infinite chain, and then let's pick some box of some finite size, and then we look at all possible operators that are defined on that finite box. So any operator A can be expanded in a basis of operators on that box. And then we simply look at the minimal value of the trace distance of the norm of this commutator of A with the Hamiltonian of your system. So if you find an operator A which minimizes this commutator, then you will effectively have a candidate for this local integral motion. And so you can go through some algebra and you can show that this minimization problem essentially can be expressed as an eigenvalue problem of this matrix Cij, where Ai and Aj are just some basis operators or operators of a basis in this box here. And then when we look at that matrix, we can find the best commuting operator, which is indeed that tau operator that I was talking about. And so this is a log of the operator density of that tau. So it's centered around some site I. So this is our box. Our box is this. So the center is here. And then you see that it exponentially decays away from that center site. So you get an operator which has an exponentially decaying tail. Yes?
What is operator density?
Well, you essentially, you can define it in various ways, but you're essentially just tracing out the, you know, the middle site and then the next two sites, the three sites, and so on. So then you can decompose it into contributions, you know, how much weight you have on this middle site, how much you have on the next two, on the next two, and so on. So you essentially get the spatial profile of this operator. And indeed it looks as you expect it to look. The other thing we can do is we can look at how that the eigenvalue of this matrix, how it scales with system size. And then we see that there's a different scaling depending on whether you are in ergodic phase or in the localized phase. So in ergodic phase, that eigenvalue, this is not looking very clear, sorry about that. So this eigenvalue, the log of that eigenvalue, scales as a power law of system size, of subsystem size L. Whereas in MBL phase, it scales exponentially. So that's something that you can learn from this to distinguish ergodic versus many-body localized phase. And one more thing. So what's special about these MBL systems is that you don't only find one operator, but you're supposed to find extensively many of these operators. And that's indeed what we see. So we can look at the entire spectrum of this localization matrix. And then we find that there's extensively many operators in the low energy part, the low energy subspace of that matrix. So these points here, each one of them corresponds to an MBL operator. So remember, if you have L operators, they will, together, they can build 2 to the L operators that commute with your Hamiltonian. So for example, if we have a box which has 7 sites, then 5 of these sites will be in the bulk and one on each end. So these end sites are just the finite size effect. And then you expect to find essentially 2 to the 5 minus 1 operators, which is 31. So indeed, those are the MBL tau operators and their products. So this, there's a lot of information here, but the main message is we can find these tau operators and we can check various properties that they have, and everything basically supports this simple picture that I outlined here. So, okay, so that's nice. But there's a question, if you have these local integrals of motion, how do they affect the entanglement in your system? So we know that the entropy will obey the area law, but what about, for example, the entanglement spectrum? So that's what I want to tell you about. So I want to tell you about the universal properties of the entanglement spectrum that follow because of these integrals of motion. Okay, so just as a little bit of introduction, so if we look at entanglement spectrum, that's something that has been studied in a whole variety of different systems. So for example, there has been a lot of work on free systems. So free systems, you can use Wick's theorem. So you know that the reduced density matrix can essentially be written in this form. So everything is determined by, it has this simple Gaussian form. And then if you look at the entanglement spectrum of some free system, like let's say transfer Ising model, then you will see that it has this structure like this. So clearly it has some exponential structure because of this form here. And people have computed this many, many times in various cases. So that's one thing that we know about the entanglement spectrum, which is pretty generic. So if you have a free system, you will have exponentially decaying entanglement spectrum if you just order these Schmidt coefficients by rank, basically. The other thing that we know about are critical systems in one dimension. So those are very nice because essentially conformal field theory can describe all of their properties, and usually it all just comes down to the central charge. So for example, the entanglement spectrum has a universal form in those cases, and essentially the whole shape of this entanglement spectrum is just determined by the central charge of the CFT. So recently people are also interested in what happens if you perturb around these limits. And it seems that that kind of universality still survives in that case. So we know some universal information about critical systems. Now, another piece of work that recently came up was to investigate the entanglement spectrum of random systems, so thermal systems. And there it was also found that it has a universal form, which is essentially given by this Marchenko Pasteur distribution. So that's something that comes out of random matrix theory. So it's the distribution, which is written out here, which describes the asymptotic density of eigenvalues of a certain kind of matrix, which is the Wishar matrix. So it's a matrix which can be written as a product X times the transpose of X. Okay, so X is a random matrix, and then you take a product with a transpose, and you ask about the distribution of eigenvalues of this Y. Okay, and so it satisfies, it was proven in mathematics that it satisfies the distribution, which is the Marchenko-Pasteur. And then essentially you can predict what the entanglement spectrum is going to look like in such a random system. So if you introduce this K, which is just the index which is labeling the Schmidt coefficients, and then if you rescale the lambda k square, so lambda is the actual Schmidt coefficient, then there is a relationship between these two, which can be derived from this distribution. So the entanglement spectrum is going to look like this. And indeed, if you compare the actual, let's say, thermal system, like a thermal spin chain, with the prediction of this Marchenko Pasteur, you get very good agreement. So random systems also have some kind of universality, and also thermal systems have the same type of universality. Yeah.
So the first qualities about the entanglement spectrum of a limited system with respect to a cat, between left and right.
Yeah.
Can you repeat what?
It's the same thing here.
It's a plot of what?
This is entanglement spectrum.
Of a mixed state.
No, of an eigenstate, but highly excited, let's say, eigenstate, of a pure.
Of a pure an eigenstate of a Hamiltonian?
Yes. So take that spin chain that I was talking about, look at the middle of the spectrum. It's a closed system, so you pick some pure state, you cut in half, you calculate the entanglement spectrum, order it by rank, you plot it, and it looks like this. And
why does it have a final K? Or why does this not?
Oh, this is not because you cannot get middle spectrum eigenstates of infinite systems. So this is a finite size calculation, yeah. So, yeah.
a thermal, for a thermal state, it would still look the same.
Yeah, I mean, I don't expect. Okay, good. So here are three examples of universality. Now, what can we say about many-body localized systems? So let me give you the main result. So we also found that there is a universal property of entanglement spectrum in many-body localized systems. So now when you have strong disorder, and that's now a power law distribution, okay? So it's not exponential, it's not this Marchenko-Pasteur, it's a simple power law. So lambda k, the Schmidt coefficient, is 1 over k to some exponent. And that exponent will essentially be given by the many-body localization length. So it's not truly universal if you're a purist, because it still depends on this many-body localization length. But it is a very generic property of these systems. And so this is a result from, let's say, several kinds of simulations where we find the entanglement spectrum as a function of this number k. And you see that it seems to obey this kind of relationship. And I will tell you a little bit about analytically why this happens on the next slide. But so first, just two things to emphasize. So these are, of course, the different system sizes that we put together. So this is different from typical ground states of gap systems, because in those cases, we find that the entanglement spectrum should decay exponentially rather than as a power law. So that's one difference. That's interesting, because if we just compare the entropy, a gap system would have an entropy that satisfies the area law. These systems, they also satisfy the area law, yet if you look at more closely at the entanglement spectrum, there's a difference, okay? So the entanglement spectrum distinguishes these two kinds of systems. So that's one thing. The other thing, I guess, why do we bother thinking about these things? Well, it's very useful if there is some kind of universal law of this type, because if nothing else, it can be useful to benchmark some kind of variational optimizations which are based on entanglement, such as DMRG or anything else applied to this context. So those are, you know, determined by how fast your Schmidt coefficients decay, and so this would give you a nice way of estimating, you know, the accuracy of the calculation that you may attempt.
So this means that up to that, so I'm confused. So it decays in a power law up to some k, and then it starts to decay more rapidly, or is this what you're saying?
So this is a finite size effect, because these are all finite simulations. Again, if it were an infinite system, this would just keep going on
forever. So then how can it be? So this is an many-body localized state. So you have, is this still efficiently representable with an FPF?
Well, it's still area law. So it doesn't spoil that. So in principle, I think it's okay. I mean, normally when people talk about these things, they usually talk about entropy, right? So as long as it's area law, it should be fine. And it is area law, but there is some finer structure which is hiding inside of this thing. Okay, so that's something. At this stage, it's empirical. So let's see how we can motivate this. So now this is a boring slide, but you know, may interest some people. So how does this come about from these local integrals of motion? So let's imagine that we picked some eigenstate of our system, and then we want to expand it into a product of eigenstates in the left part and in the right part. So because we assume that we are in a strong disorder here, we can label these eigenstates by essentially these local integrals of motion restricted to the left or to the right. And then there are some expansion coefficients here. And for simplicity, let's say we focus on an eigenstate where all these taus are basically pointing up. Okay? So that's some typical eigenstate. I'm not losing any generality here. It's just for convenience. Then we can compute the reduced density matrix for the, let's say, right subsystem. And we can write it in this form. So I introduce this vector psi, which is essentially just a way of organizing these coefficients. Okay? So these are psi mu contains all the c's, which have that fixed mu, and then all the possible values of chi in the right subsystem. Okay? So that's just a kind of convenient way of organizing this information in this form. And now the key is to look at the structure of these coefficients. So because these coefficients are labeled by these integrals of motion, they will have a hierarchical structure depending on what these integrals of motion are. So for example, if I look at the coefficient like this, so all the spins are up on the left, and then down, down, up. So there is a cut here. And then on the right, I have up, up, down, and then all the rest are up. So what this means is that I flipped these two spins, and then this spin here. So these are separated by some distance r, and that distance r essentially controls how fast that coefficient decays. So that coefficient is just some c times e to the minus r, essentially.
Sorry, why is that?
It's just because of this effective Hamiltonian. Remember that you have tau, tau, that decay inversely, e to the minus inverse distance of these two. So if you started out from all spins being up, and you make some number of flips.
Spin tau, tau, right?
Yes, these labels are the eigenvalues of taus. So if you look at the weight, if you look at this coefficient, you flipped taus, which are separated by some distance r, and that means that that term will be suppressed by e to the minus r.
But did you explain why?
It just directly follows from the fact that the Hamiltonian looks like that.
But it depends on which eigenfield of the Hamiltonian you're trying to represent. Right?
Yes, but I said that I'm starting from from this eigenstate. So I is the one that had all the...
Okay, it's the up.
Yeah, but it's a typical eigenstate somewhere in the middle of the spectrum. It has a random energy, which is somewhere in the middle of the spectrum.
And when you have this tensor problem decomposition, can you say again what mu left are?
So those are the eigenstates on the of your left and the right subsystem.
What's an eigenstate of the left subsystem?
So you can take like a left subsystem. And you can take its eigenstates, and then
you mean the Hamiltonian?
Yeah. And then you can take tensor products of these, and because we are at strong disorder, that's a good basis to expand the actual full eigenstate of your system, and you can use these taus to essentially label that.
Thanks.
So there is hierarchical structure in these coefficients, which is determined by how many flips you make inside of them. And so if you look at this full thing psi, then you can essentially write it like this. So you can, I'll give an example in a second. So don't be scared by this expression here. So parametrically, it depends like e to the minus kappa r on the left. So r left would be the distance from the cut to the farthest flipped spin in the left part. So kappa is 1 over xi, the localization length. And then these are the parametrically organized coefficients depending on the number of flips in the right. So I'll give, let's give a simple example. So let's consider just the two first blocks, OK? So in the first two blocks, I have only these four possibilities. So I have all the spins up on the left, all the spins up on the right. Here it's all the spins up on the left and one flip on the right. Here it's one flip on the left. And here it's two flips on either side of the cut. So if you look at these vectors psi, psi 1 is going to be some number, which is the order 1, corresponding to that configuration. And then some other number on the order 1, times e to the minus kappa. So that's psi 1. And psi 2 would be some number of the order 1 times e to the minus kappa, another number. Now it's e to the minus kappa square, because the distance here is 2. Here the distance is just 1. Here the distance is 0. And here it's also 1. So you see that there are two vectors in this simplest case, and they depend on kappa like this. Okay. So now that I have these vectors, if those vectors were orthogonal, just their norm would give me the Schmidt eigenvalues and the entanglement spectrum. But the problem is that these vectors are not orthogonal, so you have to orthogonalize them. Okay? So let's see how that works out. So the norm of the first one is something on the order 1, okay? But then you have to orthogonalize the second guy. So if I orthogonalize the second guy, if you work through this, you'll see that it gives me something which is on the order of a to the 4, where a is e to the minus kappa. So I have one eigenvalue which is on the order 1 and another one which is e to the minus 4 kappa. Okay, so that's in the simplest case. Now you can just work this out if you have more and more flips. And basically, if I'm in some block with r flips, the magnitude of these Schmidt coefficients is typically going to be e to the minus 4 kappa times that r. Okay. So there are many of these eigenvalues in that block k. So k is now labeling going from 2 to the r minus 1, plus 1 all the way up to 2 to the r. And then if you ask now what's the typical lambda k as a function of k, you can just invert this formula, essentially saying that k is 2 to the r. So r is log k divided by log 2. And then plugging that in, it gives you some power law that looks like that. So lambda k is 1 over k to lambda, where lambda is proportional to kappa. So this is a very heuristic, it's not a real proof, but it just tells you that because of this hierarchical structure in these coefficients, it gets translated into these Schmidt coefficients, and you could generically expect some power law scaling in them rather than exponential scaling. Okay? There's a lot of information here. You can read more details about this. But I just basically wanted to convey the main message here that essentially the power law has this form. The entanglement spectrum has a power law form. And that form is determined by the fact that you have these local integrals of motion present in the system. All right, so there are two possible criticisms to this. One is what happens if you have some eigenstate which is not completely localized. So let's imagine that you have an eigenstate which is everywhere localized, but there's some finite area which is thermal. Okay? So that's possible. I mean, you could be in MBL phase and find such things with exponentially small probability. But then it's a valid question to ask, how does that affect the power law that I was just talking about? And the other criticism is this behavior really universal? I mean, I've just discussed it for one particular model, but what if you consider other models? So the answer to this criticism here is you can show that this thing doesn't really spoil the entanglement spectrum, so it's still a power law. It's just that the onset of the power law occurs somewhere later in your spectrum. So the entanglement spectrum would look like there would be some intermediate part where there's no power law, but then distances beyond some special value, it would again be the power law. So that's the answer in this case. The answer to that criticism is that, well, I mean, we've looked at various other models. So, for example, spin 1 models transfer sizing model, and it seems that you find the same thing in all these cases. So again, you find, for example, in Heisenberg spin 1 model, you find the same type of power law. So at least by finding several examples, we could say that it's essentially universal. All right, so I'm running a little bit out of time, so I apologize. This is the first time I've given this talk. I wanted to tell you also about this other thing, which I will not do in full details, but I just want to motivate it a little bit. So the other thing, the other question that I wanted to ask is, can this entanglement spectrum be useful as some kind of diagnostic to tell if the system is free, or if it can be written out as free, or does it have some kind of genuinely interacting form? And it cannot be expressed in terms of some free particles. So the motivation is, if we have a free system, then we've already seen that the reduced density matrix of that system is highly constrained. So it must have a form like this. And so if you look at the entanglement spectrum, that means that the entanglement spectrum also has a very kind of special shape. So if I have an example, this is, for example, an entanglement spectrum that has 4 levels. So because of this symmetry, I don't know if I should call it symmetry, but this constraint on the reduced density matrix, basically the entanglement spectrum has to be symmetric around the middle, okay? So if these are the entanglement energies, the epsilons, then because you combine them in this combinatorial way, it means that the structure will always be symmetric around some middle point. That's just because if I have energies epsilon 1 and epsilon 2, they can either both be empty, or I can fill them by one particle, or I can fill them both. So then you have a symmetry around the middle point. Okay. So there is some special structure that you have in the entanglement spectrum of free systems, which is not present in a generic entanglement spectrum. So the motivation is, if you have some quantum many body system like this, you want some kind of machine which will take that, and it will return, you know, the closest free system that reproduces that entanglement spectrum as best as it can. So that's the motivation. So of course we are not the first ones to think about this. In fact, we rely on this quantity, which is called the trace distance. So we compute the trace distance between. So we have some reduced density matrix rho that we are given, and then we want to find a free density matrix sigma, which is closest to rho in some sense. And so how do we quantify that? Well, we introduce this quantity, which we call interaction distance. So it's essentially the minimum of the trace distance over the entire manifold of free state sigma. So the trace distance, if you open Nielsen and Chuang or any book like that, it's given by this. So it's some kind of measure, geometric measure, on reduced density matrices. Okay? And now we want to find the sigma, which is a free system density matrix, which minimizes that. Okay, so that's what we call interaction distance. So this sigma, as I wrote it here, it's given in terms of some modes, and these modes C, they could be typically bosonic or fermionic modes. So this is what we usually work with in condensed matter physics. So finding this sigma from this minimization problem, it seems like it's something pretty complicated, because you have these two operators, and then you have to minimize this thing between them. But you can actually show that it's sufficient to just that trace distance has to be minimized when they're both simultaneously diagonal. So as a consequence, it's enough to just look at the spectra of these two and try to match the spectra. So basically, this minimization problem just becomes a problem of finding these energies epsilons, which determine the spectrum of sigma. So the spectrum of sigma is given by these energies epsilon, and it's a free spectrum, so we just put these occupancies, 0, 1 for fermions. So then computing this trace distance is much more manageable because the minimization problem just reduced to finding these single particle energies. And that has a complexity which is on the order of L. If I have a spin chain of L spins, then I just have to find L single particle energies that will minimize the difference between these two entanglement spectra. Okay? So that's something that you can easily do. And okay, we don't have to use this particular measure. You can use other measures such as relative entropy. Yeah.
So you're using a generic unitary transformation there. So you have a notion of free system, which is maybe not the same as the one that we usually take. This U is a generic unitary.
Yeah.
It's not one that is generic. It is generated by a quadratic form in those anymore. So, and that's key to your derivation. So basically, after transforming the scene, they cannot be expressed as a linear combination of the original scene.
Yeah. That will give you interesting stuff, I think.
Sure, sure. But this, so these C's that you are considering, they cannot be efficiently parameterized.
Yes, perhaps.
You are considering
perhaps.
An extension of free particles.
Yes,
they cannot be efficiently parameterized themselves.
Yes.
Which, you know, makes you wonder why you are interested in that system of free particles if we don't have an efficient way of simulating it.
Well, you can still, for practical purposes, you could learn some techniques of approximating something which looked really, really complex. And, you know, with this, it becomes very manageable within the system sizes that you can deal with at present day.
If you find the U, that's the trick for you, right?
Well, no, but because of this, I mean, we are actually not minimizing over U. We're just matching. We just minimize over these single particle energies.
What I'm saying is that single particle systems are interesting among other things because you have an efficient way of simulating them.
Yes.
If that was your interest, you've lost that possibility here. The free, what you call a free system here, which I agree with extending the definition of free system, but it's not one that would lead to an efficient simulation because you would need to know this U, which is exponentially hard.
Yeah, I agree that actually writing down the free model Hamiltonian for that would be more complicated. Yes.
Exponentially hard.
But we can still learn some interesting things about these systems. Like for example, what are the regions in the phase diagram where they are most likely to be the farthest away from, let's say, free points. So where, you know, because truly interacting regions is where you expect most new physics to come out, right?
This notion of generalized free points that you're referring to.
Yes. So let me just give a quick example. So, okay, this is quantumizing model. I'll finish with this. So we all love this model. Okay, so it's this is just ferromagnetic or anti-ferromagnetic nearest neighbor XX, and then we have the Z field. So that's the usual transversizing model. And then you add a perturbation in form of the longitudinal field, and that makes this system complicated. Okay, we no longer are able to solve it. And then we want to know if we have a phase diagram as a function of these two fields, how does it behave? How far is it from a free description? Okay, and so here we show that phase diagram, and the color scale denotes this interaction distance, how far we are from the closest possible free model, okay? So this is a log scale, as you see. And you see that we are dealing with quite systems that are quite close to free points because this quantity is very small throughout the diagram. But now you see interesting things. So for example, this is ferromagnetic, this is anti-ferromagnetic. So in the ferromagnetic case, the maximum of that distance is somewhere close to this famous Ising critical point. So the maximum is concentrated here. The rest of the phase diagram is essentially free. So this quantity is very, very small, which means that we found a free system. In the antiferromagnetic case, it's different because now the critical point is actually a critical line, but again, similar story. So this interaction distance is biggest somewhere concentrated around that critical line. So it tells you that there is something interesting here and over here. Now, how can you be sure about this? This is a small finite size simulation. Yeah.
So can I ask you a very quick question? So here, do you always use a free fermion presentation? Have you thought about comparing them with, say, the density matrix with free boson?
That's a good question. So in principle, we should be optimizing. So the choice of the statistics enters into these occupations, right? So we can treat these modes as bosons, fermions. So for this simple model, we just use fermions because we sort of know what's going to come out.
In principle,
I could use XXZ model, which is actually solvable rather in terms of bosons if you're in the XY phase, for example.
The reason I'm asking is because physically, when you have very big longitudinal field that polarizes the system, then the low energy excitation are magnons, which are essentially free bosons. So I can imagine that boson-based would work slightly better.
Yes, this is it's a very good point in principle that we should be actually checking different types of quasi-particles as well. So this calculation was just done with fermions, but there are actually many physical systems where we know that the original particles may have nothing to do with the actual effective particles that emerge at the end of the day. Okay. So here, it's still fermions at the end of the day, but there could be other models, and we should check that, of course. So now, we've also done some finite size scaling of this phase diagram, so to make sure that this is not some kind of artifact of finite system. And so we use this finite size scaling ansatz, and then essentially we see that this quantity, this interaction distance, it fulfills this very simple finite size scaling, and then we can get these critical exponents. And actually, some of them are related by conformal field theory, which is well known for this particular model. So for example, this exponent mu, that has to be the usual exponent which governs the correlation length, so that's not a surprise. But we have this other exponent zeta, and that one is interesting because it tells us about the renormalization properties of the model, we think. Because you see it has different sign in these two cases. So what does that mean? In the ferromagnetic case, so we take this cut through the diagram, and we plot different system sizes, and then we can scale them via that ansatz. And we see that this zeta is basically negative, which means that this thing blows up. So in thermodynamic limit, this phase diagram will be completely white, and there's a huge peak here right at the critical point. On the other hand, in the antiferromagnetic case, the entire phase diagram will become completely white. So it's even simpler than that. So this model will be completely free in the entire phase diagram. This one will be free everywhere except in the vicinity of that critical point. Okay, there's some scaling here. So what are the open questions here? So as Giffre pointed out, so actually constructing a free model instead of just measuring how far it is something which is much more challenging. In this simple case, we can actually do it because we know what we have a reference point. We know that the transverse Ising is free, so we know what the closest free model is. So I'll show the results in a minute. But the second objection is, of course, you probably are wondering, can you apply this to some system which is not solvable? So something which is genuinely interacting, and can you learn something about those kind of systems? And of course, the main candidates would be something like quantum spin liquids or fractional quantum Hall states. So that's the usual suspects of many-body systems. So how do we answer this for our example? Well, as I said, we know that the model is free on this line. So actually, if I pick any point in this phase diagram, the effective free model will be one particular point on this line here. So if I sit here, this number tells me what's going to be the effective field on this line of the closest free model. So if I'm here, I would have to go to the field 15 and take that free model, and that will describe me accurately the physics of that point here. So for any, basically, any point in that phase diagram, I can assign some number like this, and you see that it has this nice structure with these lobes, which is because of, perhaps because of this duality that strictly holds on this line. So this thing maps small and large HZ map to each other because of the duality of the model. So this we can do in this simple example because we know this point is free, and so we are cheating a little bit. But if we don't know, if we don't have a free reference point, this task will become much more challenging. So that's one thing we can do. Now this is far more interesting. So at this stage, so can we come up with some examples where this thing is going to give something useful? And some people are already, they have been on the track of this. So in the quantum Hall context, so we know that if we have an integer quantum Hall state, so that's a non-interacting state, and it has the entanglement spectrum, which looks like this. So it's just a free boson in conformal field theory language. So this is a free entanglement spectrum. Now, can you use that as a reference point to describe some fractional state, like a Laughlin state? And so in this paper here, people have played around with that idea a little bit. So they take this reduced density matrix of a free system, so integer quantum Hall state, but then they expand these energies as some kind of series, and then they have these variational coefficients A0, A1, A2, A3. And so in this paper, they show that if they just keep these four coefficients, they can reproduce the entanglement spectrum of this Laughlin state, which is a many-body truly interacting state by people's usual impressions. So they can reproduce that entanglement spectrum with just these four parameters in some very, very large system to some pretty good accuracy. So it seems like, at least in some cases, it should be possible to work out this dictionary. You know, if you are interested in an entanglement spectrum of a Laughlin state, you know, you could just have some recipe which tells you these coefficients, and then you just use the integer quantum Hall state entanglement spectrum, and you get to some accuracy what you wanted to get in the first place. Okay, I'm out of time, so. To conclude, the entanglement spectrum still has some nice new things that it can tell us about many-body systems. So in the first part, I've shown you that basically if you look at these disordered many-body localized systems, the entanglement spectrum has a universal power law form. So lambda k is proportional to k to minus some coefficient, and that coefficient depends on the many-body localization length. So that's something that applies to many of these models, and it's a consequence of these integrals of motion that these systems have. And then in the second part, I played a little bit around with this idea of interaction distance, and, well, I tried to suggest that it could be maybe a useful way to learn something about some principal, very complicated systems, and try to get some kind of simple description of these systems rather than solving the full many-body problem. Or we could take some model, we could look at this thing, this interaction distance, and then it could tell us, you know, where the model is most interacting, and then focus, you know, on that regime of parameters to maybe apply different techniques or whatnot to just try and figure out what happens in those regimes. Okay, so just to conclude, so I want also to acknowledge various people who participated in this. So let me mention the students especially. So Tom worked on these integrals of motion while I was here at Perimeter, so together with the Dima and Giffre. Then the stuff about the entanglement spectrum, power law, was done by Alexis, my other student, who is actually in Nottingham, and Maxime, whom you probably know. And then the last stuff by my student Chris and Yanis and his student Konstantinos. And just to close this with one announcement, so if you're interested in these ideas about many-body localization and stuff like that, we're going to be running this, I believe it should be a nice workshop in London. Well, it's not the best time of year, but so next February. And it's hopefully going to involve discussions with a number of experimentalists in this field. And hopefully there'll be some new developments that we will hear about at that point. And well, thanks all for listening.
Can I ask a question about the distribution of the entanglement spectrum? I remember you mentioned that for ergodic system, there is a universal distribution. I'm a bit confused. So I could imagine there's a universal distribution of density of entanglement energy levels, so to speak, or density of states, so to speak. But when you plot those results, it seems to me that you're plotting the entanglement spectrum for energy level as a function of rank.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
So I'm a bit confused here because, for instance, when you plot the result for the solar system and all the solar system, I would imagine that these numbers be fluctuate, right?
Yeah. So the results for the disordered system are, of course, averaged over disorder as well as over eigenstates. Maybe I wasn't clear on that. If you picked a fixed disorder realization, of course you won't get the clear power law. Mm-hmm. You may get
So in the disorder case, the data point that you show is actually the average of say number one or number average number two.
It could be the average. It could be a mean. But it's some statistical rather than a single realization.
I see. So if you do the same calculation for say for Anderson insulators, so for three Fermion systems, would I expect the same power law distribution?
No. Well, first of all, that one will have very few levels, I guess.
Uh-huh.
And it will be exponential. There's no reason to have a parallel there.
So back to this case with thermal state or finite energy density state in a ergodic system. Maybe I'm wrong, but I have this impression that the modular component or the reduced symmetry, the logarithmic of reduced symmetry, is somehow related to the local component. So if you truncate the original component to that area, then that's pretty much is the modular component for that region. Of course, there's going to be corrections coming from interactions across the boundary. But if that's the case, then the entanglement energy levels would be the same as the, in a sense, the energy levels of this local component, right? So would that mean that the density of states for entanglement spectrum would be somehow related
perhaps. I mean, it's not something that's in the paper, so they haven't studied it. It seems like something worth checking, but I cannot say.
Thanks.
Yeah, seems plausible to me, but.
Well, I guess there are no other questions. Thanks a lot for your time.